presenters today, Jamie Feller, Karen Larson, and Curtis Budge, for their participation in sharing their learning, which is the cornerstone of our innovation incubator work. As most of you know, the Commission's goal is to drive transformational change. And one way that we do that is to inspire change by creating innovative pathways to well-being. And that's highlighted in the Commission's strategic plan. And a core part of that plan is to be a better partner with counties and to support the creation, development, and evaluation of innovation projects. Most of you may remember that in 2018, the Commission was provided with $5 million over 2 years to develop new ways to reduce the number of individuals in the criminal justice system. More specifically, those found incompetent to stand trial.
Project, where we had one cohort that supported five counties to link criminal justice and behavioral health data to better understand the needs of individuals with mental health issues in the criminal justice system. We also have a second cohort of the same project that supports five additional counties, and some of them are linking their work to the Judicial Council to divert individuals. Another multi-county collaborative is with Full Service Partnerships. We currently have six counties that are evaluating and refining their FSPs to improve results from this whatever it takes approach. And we're also considering a second cohort. A third one is the Scientific Advance Directives. We currently have three counties with more pending that are exploring ways to deploy advanced directives, improve the response to individuals in crisis from law enforcement and physical and behavioral health workers. The fourth multi-county collaborative is the one that you're going to hear about today, which is called Crisis Now. We have approximately 9 counties, but potentially 10 that are developing comprehensive and financially sustainable crisis response systems to better meet the mental health needs of individuals and reduce incarcerations. So again, very excited to hear today's presentation. The last two are fiscal sustainability, where we have three counties that are assessing the effectiveness of interventions to reduce justice involvement and develop strategies to improve performance and financial sustainability of these projects. And the last one is a systems change project. And that is a project that has the learnings across these innovation behavior projects, working with county leaders to develop a continuous improvement framework to support the development of innovation projects, and also assess how the commission can best support those counties in developing these innovations across the state. As you can imagine, this is a lot of work is going into these innovation incubator projects, but we're learning a whole lot. And through these webinars and the work of Sadiq's team, that we have an incredible opportunity to share these insights and learnings. And so through this work, we're helping the commission achieve their goal of transforming our public mental health system through innovation. I want to remind everyone that these projects provide expertise and resources to help counties and community partners address unmet needs, improve results, and reduce racial and ethnic disparities. Additionally, these projects are also addressing priorities that are already set in the MHSA, like reducing school failure, incarceration, and hospitalization. Overall, I cannot emphasize that this is an opportunity to demonstrate how innovation can transform systems
and help those who cannot always help themselves. Again, I want to thank you all. Thank you all for all that you do in our communities. It is so valuable, and I am so looking forward to all that we can learn from each other. And with that, I would like to pass the baton over to our esteemed presenter, Jamie Feller of RI International, who has been working with our counties to implement the Crisis Now model. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Shaw. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Let me introduce myself. My name is Jamie Feller. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at RI International. That's a beautiful title. Love that title. But in reality, what I've spent the majority of my time in the last 5 years doing is consulting, both nationally and internationally on how a system can be optimized around its crisis services. I don't know how many of you have done consulting in the past, but the role of a consultant is fairly interesting. You come into a new environment, you learn as much as you possibly can about it, you try to analyze what the gaps are, try to analyze what the strengths are, and then come up with recommendations on how a good system could move to great, bad system could move to good, great system could move to world class. And that's really what I've been doing for the past 5 years, but I have noticed that there are a couple of issues that go on with consulting. I'm going to talk about that as we move through. I just have an understanding that the benefit of my position has given me lots of access into a lot of systems. Some great, some bad, all of them have something to go ahead and teach. And really part of the goal today that I've got is to help you kind of move along with some of the learnings that I've particularly had. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to start with the state, if we can move the slide along. I want to talk a little bit about why the need for crisis services. What we've seen in the last 20, 25 years is an increase in suicide rates and an increase in overdose rates. Suicide currently is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., and while we are bending the curve back on the majority of other leading causes of death, we still have seen a 35% skyrocket since 1999 in people dying by suicide. Overdose rates are even worse than that. We've seen a 336% increase nationwide in people dying by suicide. Staggering numbers. Nothing that we would have anticipated 40 years ago, and certainly not when we consider the advances that we're making on the medical side, that this would become a leading cause of death, and specifically for those that are under 50 as well. Go ahead and advance, please. So part of it, I think, does come back to, and some of the research is going to go ahead and tend to show, is that it has to do with access to care. We've got very strong systems in place to respond to somebody having chest pain, strong systems in place for somebody who's had a car accident, but we're still utilizing some of the same systems in a crisis approach that have been going on since the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 5 or 10 years ago. So I want to sit there and I want to talk about a little bit about the difference in care you might anticipate with two life-threatening health conditions. So one is chest pain. If I'm having chest pain in my home, I can call a dedicated dispatch number that's specially trained to support my particular issue. I call 911. If they can't stabilize me on the phone, and they're really not going to stabilize my chest pain on the phone, they're going to go ahead and call a dedicated medical response to come to my house to see me and see if they can go ahead and support. They're going to call an ambulance. They're going to call the fire department with paramedics to come out, put me on an EKG, go ahead and run me through questions, check my oxygen levels, and really do a good assessment. If they feel they can't stabilize me on scene, and they probably won't be able to with a chest pain, they're going to take me to a dedicated medical facility that's able to go ahead and provide specific, focused medical care. That's going to be the emergency department, a specific agency, entity, facility, location, specifically designed to treat my medical condition and stabilize me. Now, the reality is if I get to the emergency department and they're able to stabilize me in the first 23, 24 hours, they're probably going to return me back into community with an outpatient referral for my primary care physician. But if they can't, if it's something that they can't connect with or something they can't stabilize, they're going to put me onto a medical floor. Now, if we take a look at how our system is built for an equally dangerous health condition, suicidal ideation, what generally happens the majority of times, much more than we call a call center, that initial call is going to come into 911. Once again, they're very good with medical, fire, legal. Now, instead of dispatching an ambulance, which is a medical professional, they're going to go ahead and dispatch, generally, a police officer to come and do a welfare check. And we do believe that police are getting increasingly trained in how to respond to the behavioral health, mental health, substance use disorder crisis. But in reality, that's not what their primary role is going to be. So instead of getting a focused behavioral health response to my home, I'm getting a police officer. And that police officer in most communities has three options when they encounter somebody with a behavioral health issue in the community. They can take that person to an emergency department, safety, security, and some form of health care, even if it's not behavioral focused. They can generally find some charge to go ahead and take that person to jail, correct me, from Magellan Healthcare, which is a large funder, national funder, and Mike Hogan. And Mike Hogan, for those of you who know, he's really the godfather of behavioral health commissioner, serving as behavioral health commissioner for over 25 years combined in New York, Connecticut, and Ohio. And what they did is they convened 35-plus national leaders from a variety of disciplines. They brought in academics, government, providers. They brought in funders, first responders, peer-run organizations, outpatient
security, resolving their crisis right then. Dispatched by the call center hub, they lessen the burden on local police and reduce the stigma that some feel when a uniformed officer knocks on their door. Component 3, crisis stabilization locations, which constitute the retreat model, can offer short-term care for people who need support and observation, regardless of their level of crisis. These programs operate 24/7 and are the right door to everyone in a mental health crisis, including those that may require involuntary treatment. These high-tech, high-touch facilities divert away from the emergency departments and jails while providing immediate specialized treatment. Police no longer need to decide between EDs or jail. The no wrong door approach reduces the time needed to handle these cases from hours to minutes and allows police to go back to supporting public safety, a role they're uniquely trained to do. Let's review the impact of the Crisis Now model in Maricopa County, Arizona, fourth most populous county in the U.S. In 2017, Maricopa County Police connected more than 23,000 people in a behavioral health crisis directly to crisis care, and those people were accepted 100% of the time. The Crisis Now initiatives saved the time equivalent of 37 full-time officers, reducing wait times in emergency departments for behavioral health patients by a total of 45 years, saving local hospitals and emergency departments a total of $37 million in avoided costs and losses, freeing them up to help the patients they're designed to treat while routing behavioral health patients to a course of care that's best suited to their needs, and reducing Maricopa County's overall health care costs by an estimated $260 million, more than twice the cost of Crisis Now services. To learn more about how Crisis Now can make a difference in your community, go to crisisnow.com and download our white paper.
Going to be returned back to community within the first
2.5 to 3 days, as opposed to folks that go into an inpatient psychiatric hospital that may have an average length of stay of 5, 7, as many as 11 days on average in certain states that we've seen. Let's go ahead and move forward slides. So I tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and move forward one more time. I've got the same slide twice in two different ways, but I think moving forward can do that. So we talk about the elements of crisis care. As the Crisis Service Task Force of the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention conceived kind of this model by looking at consensus best practices across the country, we could have looked at a million different opportunities or levels of care or elements for the crisis now system. We could talk about temporary and permanent supportive housing, same-day access for systems, ACT teams or FSP teams. We could talk about a wide variety of crisis respite levels of care. A lot of things go into it. We kind of felt that we needed to focus on something that was doable and actionable, and they focused on four elements, the fourth being that essential principles and practices. Everything we do in crisis has to be evidence-based. There's got to be logic behind it. We can't just create programs because it feels good or we think it might work. We need to have some of the research behind that. That means those programs are also are operating under a zero suicide and healthcare kind of initiative to really increase safety. But the three elements that we focus heavily on are those high-tech crisis call centers. And what we've seen in the last 10 years is crisis call centers, the technology has become astronomical in the way that they can go ahead and support. So the exemplar that we utilize for that is the Georgia Crisis and Access Line. They have the ability to schedule an outpatient appointment 24 hours a day. I can't get you in at midnight, but at midnight I can schedule you for an outpatient appointment in your community with an outpatient provider at 10 a.m., 11 a.m., noon the next day. That way, as crisis calls are coming in, call center has options. If they can't stabilize somebody, they are the ones that are doing the dispatching of the mobile crisis outreach teams. They've got all the vans in their GPS systems. They know where all the vans are. They know who's working, who's not working. They know what availability is, how long it's going to take them to get somewhere, and they start to coordinate that care. They also have bed tracking software, so they know every open psychiatric bed, both crisis and inpatient, in their community. So if they need to divert somebody to an inpatient program, they're not going to get turned away because there's no room at the end. They also have dashboards and reporting capabilities, so at any given time, they know exactly who in their community is in crisis, where they are in their care, what services might be needed, and they can start to adjust their workflows to go ahead and ensure that everybody's needs are getting met. Absolutely phenomenal. So in the Crisis Now model, that's imperative. It's imperative to work at that particular level of functioning. 24/7 mobile teams in the Crisis Now model are a two-person team that work in community. They're not going to the emergency departments and doing level of care assessments there, because by the time someone hits the emergency department, really the crisis system is broken down a little bit, and there should be resources at that emergency department. They're going where people live, work, and play as a two-person team to relieve law enforcement, to negate the need for law enforcement to go out there and be first responders for behavioral health crisis in the system. And what we have seen, 1,800 times per month here in Maricopa County, is that proves that law enforcement to do what their primary role is going to be, but generally it's going to keep people out of emergency departments or jails. Now, those times where those two levels of care are not going to be enough to stabilize somebody, I need a place to take them, to provide security and safety. In the Crisis Now model, communities work with crisis stabilization programs that are specific to crisis, short-term, high-risk assessment, but able to work with everybody under a no-wrong-door approach. No-wrong-door means I'll take anybody. It means if they are intoxicated or sober, I'll take them. If they're in an involuntary status or a voluntary status, I'll take them. If they've got intellectual and developmental disabilities, but they're in crisis, we're going to go ahead and take them. If they're aggressive, belligerent, combative, a familiar face or a high utilizer, you're going to go ahead and say yes. So let's look and see how this system works in Maricopa County. So you saw in the video, and that was 2017 numbers. The numbers probably increased a little bit by then. 23,000 times a police officer drops somebody off into the crisis system in Maricopa County. Now, the majority of those cases, a good portion of those cases, are going to be coming to a crisis facility, whether that person's on a voluntary or an involuntary status. Our facility, for example, in Maricopa County, and there's three facilities that work like us with three different agencies, but since 2014, we've admitted over 25,000 people out of the back of the police car, and we said yes 100% of the time. Not 95, not 90.
out and take somebody off my hands, I can leave them in community. But if I can take them to a facility, I'm dropping them off at the facility, I'm back on the street within 5 minutes within our model. Those are folks that are being diverted away primarily from jails, emergency departments, or left in community. So by 2017, 2018, this started to get a lot of national acclaim.
I don't know what's going on with this.
Doing is we're learning together. So no system is generally better or worse than others. And we tend to find the same frustrating pain points or pressure points in every community. So we thought that there would be a lot of strength and an opportunity to go ahead and learn together. So let's go a little bit deeper dive on what the Academy is. We can move forward a slide, please. Here's the goal. This came actually directly out of the proposal I made to the OAC. By sharing the modules, participants will more deeply explore well-founded and provocative crisis-now-related topics. They'll forge relationships with one another, develop productive learning habits, including making thoughtful connections among the courses. Active participants will gain the knowledge and skills necessary to transform their current crisis systems. So once again, I'm not going to give you a report and say good luck in implementing it. You're going to be able to create your own report with your own ideas based on your knowledge and the genius that you are in your own county to be able to move that forward. So let's do a little deeper dive and move a little bit forward. One more screen, please. Here's the cohorts that we're in. We've got nine counties that are represented in. We actually brought in the city of Berkeley. They've got their own unique challenges, but a lot of things that make them feel and act and think a little bit more like a county than a city. They've got their own budgets, they've got their own politics, all of that tend to go in. Let's go ahead and move one more screen. These are the components. This is the nuts and bolts of the Academy itself. We offer 17 learning sessions. 13 of them are going to be educational, where it's basically presentation. Here's thoughts, here's ideas, here are the technical elements of the program, here's concepts of funding. I'm going to actually go through each one with you, maybe not in depth, but give you a quick overview. And four of them are reporting out, where we're just kind of getting a little bit more information about where people are in the systems. Where I think the strength of this program comes, though, is in the weekly individual consultation for all the counties. So once again, it's enough to go ahead and kind of do presentations, but where I think the strength comes is every system is a little bit different. Every one of those cohorts has access to me for an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and to any of the faculty members that we've got to go ahead and support them in whatever it takes to help them move their communities forward toward a higher fidelity of the Crisis Now model so they can start to experience some of those gains that we've seen in Maricopa County. The other thing that we're looking in is a community stakeholder engagement support that is requested. I do think sometimes translating the ideas of what Crisis Now is, sometimes it is better from an outside viewpoint, somebody who can talk about it theoretically. But some of it gets fairly technical, so what we're also offering is you're meeting with stakeholders in your community, whether that's law enforcement or providers or funders or government or in your board of directors, certainly support in going ahead and explaining the things that I've explained to you today. Let's go ahead and move forward if we can. So there's a lot of tools to help us get there. So once again, the educational components certainly are helping set skills, certainly increasing knowledge base, but there's a lot of tools that I will utilize as a counselor, especially working in this space, that now become available to everybody that's in one of those cohorts. These are things like the strategic planning tools, asset mapping tools that we use, our capacity modeling tools, so we can really determine just what your system should look like as far as what the capacity needs you're going to have, how many people we can anticipate are going to be in crisis, true crisis within your community, as well as fidelity tools so you can start to match up your current providers and your current elements of that care to see just how strongly they are aligned with the true Crisis Now model, which there's a lot more than what we just kind of had talked about, as well as copies of the white papers and national guidelines. We send out articles actually every day that are on the crisisnow.com website that is created by our chief content officer around crisis-related topics that a lot of folks find benefit on. And if they don't find a benefit on a particular day, they just don't read it, and then the next one's coming around and they can. We've given out NASHBID rural and frontier guidelines because we see some small counties in our cohorts. And then there's things that, as a consultant during that technical assistance, that we're putting out there. Escalation guidelines for the Georgia Crisis and Access Line of when they might call a police officer to go out and do a welfare check versus a mobile team. What the medical protocol, medical clearance may be a necessity if facility-based. But the thing I think I'm actually most excited about now is this Crisis Now consultation report. Last year, I spent three to 6 weeks working with the state of Alaska, and we created a very nice report. It really has all the elements that you're looking for within a crisis report. And what we were finding as we were talking to some of the community cohorts, some of the county cohorts, is there was a lot of fear of how you put it all together. So having an actual consultation report, 88 pages, that the Alaska Mental Health Trust, who commissioned that, is allowing the Academy to utilize to see, A, what a good report looks like, what the elements are, but also to maybe even steal some of the ideas, steal a little bit of the narrative, a little bit of the wording, so you can see the formatting. So at the end, if a county does want to go ahead and create their own report, and several are looking toward doing that, they have the ability to go ahead and create something that they're going to have a lot of pride in, because there is a lot of fear about doing something like this. You know, I've done dozens of these over the last, you know, couple of years. I get a little bit nervous at how daunting it can feel, but having a template that you can work from makes that much easier. Let's move forward. These are the faculty that we've got currently, constantly bringing in new folks. So David Covington, who is our CEO, he's an easy get for me, but he's also the co-lead, because he's our CEO. He was also the co-lead on the Crisis Now paper. So when he talks about what the Crisis Now model is, a little bit about the history, generally he's talking from experience. He's talking about one of the two leading experts in Crisis Now across the country. Tom Bedlock is current partner at Spire Consulting, but for 26 years he worked for the state of Arizona, 16 years in their Medicaid office, 10 years as a director. For you, those of you that know, 10 years working for Medicaid as a director is three or four careers worth, but he was with Arizona as this model started to evolve, and he can specifically talk about how it's funded, why it's funded, and what the business case is. Sue Ann O'Brien is the CEO of Behavioral Health Link. That's the Georgia Crisis and Access Line. That is the exemplar for call center technology in the U.S. and actually in the world. Erica Chestnut Ramirez, she's vice president of La Frontera Impact. They are the mobile crisis provider in Maricopa County that's seen as the exemplar. So we've got other folks that are in here too, but we're really bringing in those national leaders, people that are working on the national stage, the people that are working for exemplars within this particular model to go ahead and teach the specific elements that we're looking for. And these are our folks that are also faculty. So during some of the technical assistance, we may go ahead and bring these folks in or some other folks. So Sue Ann O'Brien has talked to many communities about call centers, you know, for example, in those weekly meetings. Let's go ahead and move forward. I think we're going to get into a little bit about the sessions. I'm going to move fairly quick through this. This is our first, you know, we've got two cohorts that are going, but remember, this is our first attempt at this. So I think things might get adjusted a little bit if we were going to do this again. But session one certainly is a Crisis Now introduction facilitated by David Covington. And really, this is that introduction to what this model is, why it needs to be here, and why you should be excited to be part of a particular cohort and moving toward this model for your community. Let's go ahead and move to session two. We've got the funding. We brought that in early because generally, as I'm doing consulting, the biggest question I get is who pays for it? So really what we brought in was Tom Bedlock, once again, 10-year director of Medicaid in Arizona, the ARC funding for the Crisis Now model within Arizona. I think that that's where we certainly are looking to go ahead and be. Let's move to the next one. Call center hubs, which is we consider kind of the first element in Crisis Now, by the CEO of the Georgia Crisis and Access Line, the exemplar for call centers. Moving through. Mobile Crisis by the exemplars in Mobile Crisis, Erica Chestnut. I spent 5 years running mobile teams in Maricopa County with Taros, who's the second exemplar. So her and I kind of tag teamed that particular presentation. Then we moved into facilities, if we click on the next one. And this is by Chris Domley, who's our state director for RI, Matthew Hosclaw, who is our chief of crisis at RI International, and Chuck Browning, who's really kind of the lead psychiatrist in the country working in the crisis space around fusion models. So we're really talking about what the tenants of a facility are going to be. We then start moving into how we start modeling what the capacity is going to need to look like for your community. We start utilizing algorithms to go ahead and based on 14 different data points and you know, there's multiple ways in population statistics to anticipate how many folks in crisis you will have in your community and what levels of care are going to best correspond to them. So you can start thinking about how many mobile teams do I need? How many calls can I anticipate coming in? How many inpatient beds am I going to need? How many crisis chairs am I going to go ahead and need? All of these things start to come through this particular model. And we finished that a couple of weeks ago. Let's move to the next one. implementation. So now what we're talking about is how you create your gap analysis, which is how you do your strength, your asset mapping, and then how you do your modeling, and then how you get your gap analysis, and how you start thinking about what your recommendations may be. And this is the session we just completed. The next one. Our next one is going to be on stakeholder relations. We start that tomorrow. What I can tell you, and what I've seen in dozens of other counties across, is that you can have the best strategic plan going, the best implementation strategy that you can possibly come into, but if you don't get the buy-in of the stakeholders that are actually going to be implementing it, you're doomed to failure. You know, I can think about the Pete Drucker quote where he talks about strategy, or basically your culture is going to eat your strategy for breakfast. So if you don't bring your stakeholders in, and there's certain ways to go ahead and do that, how you might overcome the resistance, how you build community, how you start to create a culture of accountability for your community, for the crisis system, which is a little bit different. We're talking about some significant changes. Let's move into session 9. Key performance indicators. For this, I'm bringing in Debbie Atkins. She's the crisis director for the state of Georgia through the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities. We need to talk a little bit about how we know if our systems are working or not, and how we start to roll out new metrics to providers that maybe have not had these types of metrics before. Let's keep moving. Evidence-based practice, absolutely everything we do. I'm bringing in our chief medical officer to go ahead and talk about what risk assessments you want in your system, what patient placement you want in your system, what data you want to start collecting, or what those benchmarks may be. Even on how, if you're creating new facilities, how they need to be designed, how you're going to handle aggression in a no wrong door approach, all of those things go into session 7. Law enforcement collaboration, like I said, you can have the best crisis system in place. It's got to work for law enforcement. If you don't have a no wrong door approach, they're going to go to the other two agencies in your community that do have a no wrong door approach, which are going to be your jail and your emergency department. So how you collaborate with law enforcement, that you have a system that's working for them, is absolutely important. Bring in Ron Bruno for that. He's the executive director of CIT International, a Utah-based police officer, retired out of there, to go ahead and talk about that particular collaboration and move forward. Workforce development. Even before I came to California, I know because every place I go, don't have enough peers, don't have enough psychiatrists, don't have enough nursing staff, don't have enough clinicians. We're going to talk a little bit about how you may need to augment and how you may need to develop your workforce. And we're bringing in two of our folks that specialize in workforce development for that. Cigna Oliver is our director of human resources, and Lisa St. George, who is our director of peer services, to really talk about how we incorporate certified peer support specialists into all stages in the crisis now model. And our 13th is equity. Now we're still in development for that particular curriculum because things are changing. And while it is our 13th session, we've realized fairly quickly here we need to move it up. So there's opportunities for us to have that actually in the next 3 weeks. I'm working in chambers to go ahead and create that curriculum. I just need to make sure it's ready before we move that up. We can move one more. The reporting out sessions, a lot of opportunities, just kind of talk about where everybody is, build a little bit of sense of collaboration. What we did with one of the first ones, though, is we kind of augmented it with a educational session on rural and frontier considerations within the Crisis Now model. I want to move one more. Timelines. Cohort 1 is the first and third Wednesdays of the month. Cohort 2, the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month. We've got 17 sessions to go through, which gets us around 9 months, I think 8.5 months to 9 months. And for those that are working on a final report, I anticipate this is going to take about 10 months, because even after that final session, nobody's going to be ready to put this to bed yet. And we still want to do that technical assistant, stakeholder engagement model to go ahead and get people going. Let's go ahead and move one more. So what have we learned? Once again, this was our first cohort coming through, second cohort 1 week after, so everything is still kind of new. What I have learned is that each county has a different ability to commit. We've seen staffing changes, COVID-19. When we first started, we had wildfires. Some counties would bring 5 or 6 people to those meetings. Some counties would bring 1 or 2. There were different levels of ability to commit. I saw that each county wanted to think about this and wanted to work toward that, but the resources they had available is dramatically different. I see significant differences in the rural and urban counties. So we've got some counties that might be 13,000. We got some counties that might be 400,000. Their solution is going to be dramatically different. So really, as we start to kind of fuse some of those together, we need to make sure that all of our programming sessions really focus on frontier, rural, and urban areas. Each county has a different goal for the academy. Everybody wants to get something a little bit out of it. But once again, when you're doing weekly technical assistance, you can gear everything toward that particular need for that particular community. I'm going to talk a little bit about a regionalized approach in a bit, maybe when we talk about Karen and some of the initiatives she's doing. And I do think the translation of brand is absolutely appropriate. We're getting stuff from the national level that we're moving forward into the counties. So there are things that our counties are hearing a week after it's reported out by SAMHSA or NASHBID or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So the folks I'm seeing that are fully engaged in all of the sessions in the TA generally have as much knowledge probably as anybody in the state as far as what things are coming down the road. I think I've got just a slide or two left. What would I do differently? I'd place a session on equity probably second in our series. Absolutely important. And everything that we do really needs to revolve around equity. So we need to move that up. I begin to include hardwiring some urban educational programming in it. I'd work to get commitment at the highest levels of the county to support students. And by that, what I mean is if you've got a board of supervisors, if you've got a county manager, somebody that's basically signing off saying, I understand this is a priority, and I'm going to make sure that the staff that are working this process have the time to do this, and whatever competing commitments that they've got in their lives become secondary to this particular process. I also want to have a conversation with the OEC that if this is something that we can do again, that we look at doing a 1 or a 2 day immersion in Phoenix as part of the process. Maybe we get the first 5 or 6 sessions out of the way together in a couple of days while touring actual facilities, touring a mobile team provider, touring a call center to really get immersed into what the situation is. I think that's going to increase excitement, also decrease the time of the overall process, because we do know an 8 or 9 month process does get a little bit of tiring, and I want to make sure that we're not getting into fatigue. Final slide. Some of the success is actually second final slide. So I've been meeting with the legislature at recommendations of the counties, been meeting with institutes. I think one of the most important things we've done, and I may ask Karen to talk a little bit about, is we do understand that bigger is better when it comes to call centers. Each county has their own call center. They've got their own contracts. They've got their own needs. Our cohorts are looking together to have a discussion about regionalizing their call center approach. So instead of 10 call centers for 10 different areas, local center where you get economy of scale and are able to actually really improve quality, bring in that technology, and have some of that oversight. I've seen a lot of stake engagement, talking to law enforcement, scheduling to talk to some of the attorneys, some of the county attorneys about this process as well. And really what I do think is that the folks that are working, and the folks you're going to hear from about after me, absolutely are some of the more informed people you're going to run into in the state around crisis services. So I'm going to turn it back over to Kit and Katharina.
That was great, Jamie. One question that we have in here, and I urge everybody to remember to open your chat and send us some questions. One of the questions was to repeat which counties are involved. And as a reminder to all attendees, the slides will be posted, so you can go back and look at it, and you can go back and listen to this recording as well.
So cohort one is Nevada, Plumas, Butte, and the city of Berkeley. Cohort two is Yolo, Placer, Solano, Mono, and Inyo. And part of it was, those were kind of, they're close together. They're a little bit northern. There seemed to be an appetite when the OAC originally reached out for them to be part of that. And one of my other learning things was, it only took me, I'm going to say a month and a half to stop calling Placer County. I'm quite proud that I no longer do that. But I do see some of our faculty still doing that. It makes me cringe.
It happens. So right now, I'm not seeing any questions in the chat box. I'm sure people are typing. So I suggest maybe introducing Karen and Curtis.
So I'll start with Karen. Karen, Director of Human Services, Yolo County. The titles are always kind of an interesting thing. But Karen was actually the first person that I reached out to, basically at the recommendation of the OAC, to kind of run this process past after I'd gotten approval to kind of see. Karen brings a wealth of information to the sessions, but also she brings a load of people. So she has brought in attorneys, law enforcement providers, really has kind of gone gung-ho. I need her weekly to go ahead and talk about big ticket and big concept ideas, as well as very, very in-depth type of stuff. But as far as a county that really is taking advantage of everything the Academy has to offer, I think Karen is doing that. So I was hoping that Karen could talk a little bit about what her experience has been.
Great. Can I go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Sorry you had to hear me with my fifth grader who's homeschooling earlier today, but I'll just speak really quickly to Yolo County a little bit. I always say we're the Goldilocks County. We're not too big. We're not too small. We're just the right size. But there are times where our size causes complications when we're trying to scale up models, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So over the years, we have tried several different approaches to our crisis system. We, like many counties, were successful in the SB 82 grant funding. We stood up several co-responder teams throughout our county, and at the end of the three-year grant, realized that we were spending about $1 million a year for, on average, about two calls a day, which was cost prohibitive based on our size and budget. So we pivoted. We said, well, let's try an urgent care center and put in an innovation plan with the OAC. It was approved. We had this 24/7 urgent care center and had nurse practitioners provided from one of our local health systems on site, able to prescribe. And again, a three-year period, guess what? We were spending about $1 million a year for about two visits a day. And so we just realized, you know, we're no good at figuring this out on. And so when this opportunity to partner with the OAC, we're very grateful for their leadership on this and bring in Crisis Now. When that opportunity was given to us, we jumped right in. As I look through the participants on this call, I know that I have many of my county partners on here, but I also see quite a few names of people who I don't recognize. And so I'm just going to do a little county 101. There are 58 counties in California and some cities that participate as mental health plans, meaning we are the managed care provider for the Medi-Cal population for those individuals struggling with serious mental illness. It also means that every single county is responsible for certain things. One of those is a 24/7 access line. So each of the 58 counties currently has their own access line. I have to meet all the same criteria as LA County and as Mono County, who is much smaller than I. So as we started talking through the Crisis Now model, it became really obvious that we have some opportunities with each of these components potentially to regionalize. And especially when we talk about that 24/7 access and crisis number, in Yolo County, we spend well over $600,000 a year on that access line. And my partners in Placer and Solano spend similar amounts, but we have contiguous county lines and we probably could regionalize that call center model. So Jamie has been gracious enough to join us and convene several counties, not just Crisis Now counties, but also some of our partnership health plan counties at the end of March for a conversation to explore this ability to regionalize. As many of you know, that on the horizon, we have 988 coming. We have CalAIM coming, and these opportunities, in addition to our learnings from Crisis Now and our own experience with the crisis system, really put us in a unique position to potentially regionalize our crisis call centers. I will just say, in terms of the Crisis Now Academy, the educational sessions have been great. I have had more than my fair share of participants. Like Jamie said, I have law enforcement from each of my cities participating. My local mental health board participates. My local NAMI chapter participates. My health systems and our district attorney's office. So that's been great because they're able to hear the same information that my staff and I are hearing, and we can have more productive conversations. It helps with the buy-in as we look to transform our system. In addition to the session that Jamie's offered to do with the counties, I think we're up to 15 counties. I had another one ask to join the call. Jamie has also agreed to meet with all of our chiefs of police, our sheriff, and our probation chief at the end of March, and just kind of talk through the Crisis Now model and where we're headed and what makes sense for our county. So in addition to those educational sessions and the TA sessions with our line staff, Jamie's also been gracious enough to kind of help me with these larger convenings to get buy-ins from my county partners and the other systems. I will just say that vision statement at the beginning, I hadn't actually seen that before, that the OAC kind of wrote into to this project. We definitely have been achieving all of those. I feel so connected to the other counties that are participating. I feel like we are all learning from one another and more connected, and I suspect that many of us will be including some component of Crisis Now in our subsequent innovation plans. So just really grateful to the OAC and to Jamie and all of his faculty for their help. And I think that's all unless there's questions.
Thank you, Karen.
That we're juggling and just doing projects and so it seemed like it made sense for what we were really needing. So I want to really thank RA International, the OAC, for really giving us a chance to look at how we do things in our county. As we've gone through these really informative sessions, we've just been able to take a step back and look at, what does a robust crisis continuum really look like? What should it look like? I think for some time we've thought that we're doing okay. You know, we have 400,000 people in our county. Like Karen, I kind of like the size of our county. It's big enough to be able to do things. But we were kind of wondering sometimes, we felt we were doing good things. We had embedded crisis staff in our emergency rooms. We have a community mobile crisis team. We have a psychiatric health facility, an adjacent residential. We were able to contract and feed into some other facilities where people can get the help that they need. We have peer-run support respite homes. We have these things which are great. But this has just given us a chance to kind of step back and just think, how can we do better? Some other lenses and and by having Jamie and Wayne's support and their guidance, it's been outstanding. It's been great to invite some of our county partners as well on these calls. We've had some law enforcement folks be able to join, and you know, just the other day, it was really nice to have one of our sergeants from one of our law enforcement agencies. We were just exchanging a couple texts back and forth, and he's been very involved in crisis, and he's participated in many of the sessions, and we were just texting back and forth about 988, and he was wanting information, and we were just kind of talking about how exciting it could be to kind of do some of these things that the crisis now is talking about. It's just been nice to build upon already good relationships and partnerships, but see how we can even be better and get excited about some of these things that have been presented to us. I think so. With the a couple of things that just have really hit us, like again, the three main components that really loved about this are, you know, community mobile crisis, having some kind of a receiving, just a receiving center that, like Jamie says, you know, just kind of receives everyone. And then a regionalized access approach. In between these sessions that we have, these trainings that we have with Crisis Now, and what we've now started with weekly TA sessions as well, is looking at things we've kind of wanted to do, but we just haven't. And kind of having some renewed hope. There are some other systems out there that are really effective. They work. And for us to really look at how can we, in a smart way, in a better way, in a financially prudent way, look at what are the needs of our people in our county, but also, you know, for our county to be able to be even better stewards of the money that that we have to implement some of these things. One of the main things that this has helped us to look at is creating an urgent care center, which we are in the process of developing and designing and working together with some of our community partners to really build this into a place where people can come, you know, anytime and with people who are in that crisis or doesn't, you know, we want to really minimize kind of the need of going to emergency room and cut down law enforcement time and have them come. And so we're really excited about that. We have a PUF, we have a 30-day crisis residential, and this is another component of something that we need. So I think short term, it's helped us really look at what are some more needs we have. But I think what Jamie and the group has helped us do more is kind of, you know, short term, but also long term. I love the expression that Jamie used about how culture, you know, we eat strategy for breakfast, and that's really what we need to be about, is kind of looking at our culture, and even where people are going in our county, where are we meeting them, and you know, what kind of access do people have to us? You know, right now we do go into their homes, we go to streets, we go to parking lots, but how can we even build more upon that? I, through some of these TA sessions, we're able to kind of start about, you know, where Jamie was saying, you know, their diversion rates and our diversion rates to inpatient places, it's different. And how can we look to strengthen that? We have peer advocates with our community mobile crisis teams. We have a nurse on one of our community mobile crisis teams. We feel like we're being, through the help of the OAC, doing some fairly innovative things. But how can we strengthen that? And why are we sending a little bit more people to patient settings than maybe we need to? So kind of looking at that. A couple of specific things that has been really good to hear with Jamie and some of our individualized TA sessions is even how, you know, we contract out a lot of our services, and even looking at how can we kind of engage in some of our community-based organizations that with whom we contract, and how can we start some other different conversations with them? Some challenging, some uncomfortable conversations about who we accept and where do we go and how long should people be staying in facilities. And so looking at that kind of broadly and having those conversations, it's been a big help to receive some consultation around that. I had a half a page of notes, and as Jamie and others and Karen were talking, I wrote down about another half a page of notes that kind of came to me of things that we have been kind of blessed with through this process. And so I'm going to try to just really get a couple other comments I made in the last 20 minutes or so. I think just maybe some anecdotal things that have been really good for us. That's nice. And maybe all consultants do this. It hasn't been my experience, but you know, it's really nice as we're getting help from Jamie, whether it's community mobile crisis, a regionalized approach that we're really on board of looking at as well. You know, Karen's spoke to that, and you know, we have a great provider right now that provides our access services. We're in partnership with Nevada County and a great provider there, and looking at ways to expand that to even make it even a better thing. But you know, Jamie responds right away, and he emails back right away. I kind of feel like whatever we need, he's right on it, and that's something that's just been really helpful as we're trying to kind of figure all this out. And so that's just a nice thing to have, kind of in a consulting agency where sometimes that's just something that maybe we take for granted that it doesn't always happen. But he's very responsive, and so we've really appreciated that. Timely and some of the logistics and how we're setting this up and conversations we need to have and such. I think so. We've also been able to look at and support. We've had some recent conversations, you know, aside from crisis now, of even some of our more wood areas. Tahoe, Lake Tahoe is in our county, and you know, it's a you know, it's a challenging region to serve. It's very small, and so some conversations have happened aside from crisis now about how can services even be beefier, you know, in that area. But having the crisis now has helped us even more look at and support some of the different things that we want to be doing in that area as well, and really wanting to give attention to all areas of our county, not just some of those bigger areas where it's easier to have community mobile crisis teams or embed in emergency rooms and things like that. So that's been nice as well. I think with the conversation about how do we beef up our community mobile crisis and this urgent care center and looking in the future to possibly regionalize some of these services, it's been great. It's been all positive on our end, and we really appreciate Jamie and the folks that have us this opportunity.
Thanks, Curtis.
Because we have, we're, you know, technically 6 minutes left, but we can stay on a few minutes later if folks want to do that. We do have enough questions, and they kind of, you guys are all sort of on psychically on the same page in these questions, so they're kind of in three different groups. Summarize them, and then maybe the three of you will want to respond. So they're pretty similar in nature. The first grouping is, under the Crisis Now models, how does the mobile response team address violent individuals or hostile situations? In other words, how does the crisis response team address safety concerns? Is law enforcement ever utilized to secure the scene or assure the safety of behavioral health staff? So that's number one. Number two is consolidated into a grant program. How did Maricopa County pay for it? what our grant opportunities or funding opportunities out there that you know about. So that's kind of grouping number two. And grouping number three is also around how do we start a program? How would we start the process? And kind of back into that law enforcement grouping, from an advocate, there's also an interest in how officers and first responder can go to classes or they learn how to participate in a crisis now model. So there's sort of the law enforcement safety section, the funding section, and the how to start this process section.
So I can jump in and start talking if you'd like. I'll talk about the mobile teams first. So we're actually moving a little bit away talking about the academy. We're talking about the crisis now model that the academy is built on. So what I can tell you is we've been operating mobile teams in Maricopa County since 1969. We have probably been doing it with high fidelity, what would be considered the crisis now model, long before crisis now was even a model or a thought, probably for the last 20 years or so. So really, the components in crisis now for a mobile crisis outreach team are two staff. Never go individually. We always go with two staff because that does increase safety, doubles our opportunity for engagement. So what we've done is we've got good working relationships with the 25 counties. I'm going to just pick Maricopa County. There are a ton of counties that operate across the country that operate with high fidelity in this particular model. But really what we're focused on is providing the appropriate response. So what we do tend to see is 30% of the calls that come in that require a face-to-face intervention through our call center probably have a situation that we want to go ahead and have a co-response with law enforcement. They've got a gun on the phone book. They are drunk and making threats. We can hear them in the background when their friends are talking, saying these type of things. There might be a dog that we feel unsafe going out with. But what we do year in, year out, month in, month out, it's really about 3% of those cases require a co-response model, which is interesting because for every time that we call police justice in a behavioral health call, they call us about three times to help them in a behavioral health call that they end up going out there. So we've created in Maricopa County, and every community is going to do that, we've created flow sheets of when we're going to involve police and when we're not going to involve police. From a culture viewpoint, our culture is, unless we see otherwise, we're going to assume that it's safe to roll. Other communities are, unless we absolutely see something that says we're safe to roll, we're going to assume that it's dangerous. So I see a lot of communities that will have a 100% co-response rate. Mobile team will roll, but they're going to wait till police are there 100% of the time. We feel it's only about 3% based on decades worth of data. Now, if we go out on somebody and they're involuntary and we're going to need to go ahead and put them on a hold, 5150 LPS, at that point, we're going to initiate the paperwork, but the transportation has to be with law enforcement. So we will contact law enforcement to go ahead and do that transport because I can't put an involuntary person in the back of our van. That said, if somebody's voluntary for treatment and the overwhelming majority that need to go to a higher level of care are going to be voluntary once you meet them face to face, we can transport them in the van if the clinician and the peer feel safe to do so. If they don't feel safe, then we would encourage ambulance. It happens one out of every 200-300 times. So the reality is it's the culture. Our culture is we think we're safe out there unless we see something that says we're not. And if we start to go on to scene and we feel safe, we're going to go ahead and retreat back as well. But bringing police in 100% of the time is unnecessary. It is a kind of a waste of resources. And I think what we tend to see, sometimes the presence of a uniformed officer may trigger a response much different than the presence of a peer and a clinician in an unmarked van coming out in polo shirts and blue jeans. The second question was about funding. We could do 3 hours on that. Arizona went to this model because it was cheaper to go ahead and do. Giving people the right care at the right time to decrease the amount of escalation kept people out of emergency departments, and it kept people out of inpatient psychiatric hospitals. In Maricopa County, our Medicaid director estimates that for every dollar they spend on true crisis services, they save $2 in unnecessary healthcare spend. We're still in the process of determining the cost savings to law enforcement and the criminal justice system, because we do know that it costs every time you arrest somebody on a misdemeanor shoplifting charge, and they really have a mental health issue with court time, jail time, probation, you know, legal involvement to begin with, all of those things that tend to go in. The third question was how to start the process. I make up that question is how to start the process in kind of the Crisis Now Academy. How do we kind of start doing some of these things? My belief, and I haven't talked with Dr. Shah, is that we're looking to kind of get through this, learn the skill sets, really look at this as kind of a pilot and see about if replicating it does make sense, and if it does make sense, what adjustments might we make so it's an even stronger product that's out there. So I think if you have an interest in this, I'll let Dr. Shah talk a little bit about how you might be able to engage that process. And the fourth thing about law enforcement, our model is endorsed by CIT International. CIT International is kind of that training arm that's out there doing the training for officers. They'll run a 40 or an 80 hour class on crisis intervention, basically the team approach, which isn't just straight training, but it's certainly about how to incorporate. I do know that CIT obviously endorses us, but the reality on it is they were working with us in Maricopa County while we were kind of developing this entire model as well. The person that we're having to speak with, the law enforcement officers in Yolo County that Karen was speaking of, was our CIT director for nearly a decade. He was also the secretary on the board of CIT International for those years as well. So CIT International really is that leading arm in how to work with law enforcement at the intersection of mental health and criminal justice. I know I ran through fairly quick, Kit. I know we ran out of time, so.
That was really great. You summarized that really quickly. One thing I would like to mention to those of you who are still on, which is a little over half, so I know that there's a lot of interest out there. If you would like to be connected with Jamie or Karen or Curtis, we're happy to help you do that. You can reach out to us. You'll see the Words to Deeds page at fmhac.org. I think you'll also have seen that in your invitations and so forth. So you can see the drop-down menu. You can see what's posted. You can contact any of us, and we will help you connect with the presenters today. There was one question, Jamie, also, and we've got a couple of minutes left, I think. And then, again, we'll try to figure out a way to answer these questions that some of you may still have. So don't hesitate to contact us to do that. One of the questions somebody addressed, can you talk about the overdose issue? Do you see a lot of that as well? And have you had opportunity to work with that?
So once again, the Crisis Now model says we're gonna basically create a system that's single point of entry. We're going to say yes. So as somebody's coming into a facility, for example, we see about 70% of the folks coming into facilities have some kind of substance on board. So S2D, there's such high comorbidity. So in all of the crisis centers that operate as a no wrong door approach in the Crisis Now model, you have to have the ability to take folks that might have withdrawal symptoms. You have to have the ability to do detoxification, withdrawal management. Say, I know this person's suicidal, but they also need detox, so they need to go to the detox center. And then when they get to the detox center, they say, well, we can't take them, they're suicidal, they have to go over to behavioral health. You need these programs to be able to work anybody, anytime, anywhere, which means voluntary, involuntary, regardless of their SUD status. And what we tend to see is that when we're working with people coming in, they might have a primary substance abuse issue, and that's what's fueling and feeding their underlying crisis. We need to be able to address those issues as well. So Crisis Now looks at the whole plethora of crisis, substance use, behavioral health, psychosis, suicide, all of those things going into it.
Thanks, Jamie. Karen or Curtis, would you like to say anything before we kind of wrap up here? I know we went a little bit over, but we still have about half of our attendees here. So if there's any comments you'd like to make, that would be great. We had wonderful attendance today. So thank you, everybody, for hanging with us a little bit. It's a neat program. Karen or Curtis, any additional thoughts?
I don't have anything to add. Thanks for getting this together.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your constant energy. I guess you just don't sleep, right, Karen?
I don't either. I don't have any comments. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, sleeping is just so overrated, right? Thank you. Thank you all. One of the things I do want to mention is our in the series of webinars is on barriers to system change with regard to criminal justice and keeping people with behavioral issues out of criminal justice involvement. And that webinar takes place April 2nd. You'll be seeing invitations because all of you who signed up here are now on the list. So you'll see those hitting your email box, and you know, please join us and again, contact us. In the chat box, I did put the fmhac.org website there. You'll also see that the annual conference is coming up at the end of the month, March 31st, April 1st, and 2nd, which is an opportunity to get continuing education credits, as well as participate in the Words to Deeds track. But our webinar number 4 will be held in conjunction to the FMHAC annual meeting, but it's free to anyone who would like to join us. And again, that will be with social finance and that learning collaborative. So again, that's barriers to change. So again, on behalf of everybody involved, MHSOAC, Trina and her FMHAC, you guys in the Crisis Now collaboratives, Karen, I think you're in just about every collaborative that's going on in the Innovation Incubator. Thank you all so much. This is really exciting information. And again, whatever we can do, reach out to me. You'll see the fmhac.org, and we will hook you up with anybody you'd like to continue talking.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jamie.